So we'll begin chanting the Discourse on Loving Kindness, the Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Bless you. So we'll practice that a little bit each time. It's beautiful to chant it. And this is a discourse or a sutta that gets chanted. It's one of the most popular of the texts to chant in the Theravada tradition. It's chanted as part of daily practice all over the world. And it's such a beautiful invocation. I love chanting it because in the chanting it becomes, you know, more than just instructions. It's otherwise perhaps an instructional text with a beautiful maternal metaphor at its heart. But chanting it just, the beginning that we talked about last week, really giving the foundation of the path in an orientation toward one's actions. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited. And the chanting of it, it's almost like my heart, you know, feels the invocation of these qualities differently when I chant it. Of course, that's why we chant them, rather than just speaking or reading them in silence, which is also lovely. So last week we talked about this basic orientation toward spiritual life where these qualities of contentment, gentleness, humility are cultivated. And that embedded in this is this basic renunciate attitude, which doesn't mean we're becoming, you know, like celibate, poverty, obedience kind of monastics. That's one way to do renunciate practice. But for lay people, the practice becomes in a certain way subtler. You know, it becomes not about having no possessions, but about growing less attached to the possessions we do have, seeing them for their utility, their function, their beauty, but not falling into a kind of grasping or craving around them. Likewise, you know, resting into the beauty of intimate relationships, but noticing when that beauty and intimacy begins to turn toward the contracted heart of fear and grasping, of wanting and jealousy and loss and longing in a way that limits life force rather than nurturing life force. And the beautiful last line of this second sentence, you know, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. This is not easy to practice, but it's beautiful to practice. And contentment is this quality highly praised across the stream in the yoga tradition as well. It's you know, it's the second of the niyama in Patanjali's eightfold scheme called Ashtanga Yoga, the classical yoga, where the niyamas, the inner disciplines, are purification, contentment, you know, powerful discipline, self-study, and orientation toward pure awareness. And the contentment is a core discipline in spiritual practice. And mysteriously, it's part of the cultivation of well-being, not just the result of the cultivation of well-being. And this speaks to some of the beauty of renunciation, that it's not that at the end of the path when I'm fully awakened, suddenly I no longer grasp. It's actually that the practice of non-grasping is woven through the entire thing, from the very first instruction to be generous, all the way through to the letting go of the last threads that bind the heart. And then unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. And this lovely double meaning of unburdened with duties, which can both mean keep your life simple in a concrete way, and then also don't let yourself feel burdened by the duties that you do have. Be unburdened by your duties. So then the text goes on in this same vein, invoking these beautiful qualities in practice, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. So this line, in many ways, some of the same qualities, peaceful and calm, although now we start to move into, from this kind of basic renunciate orientation, peaceful and calm now speaks to kind of the inner state and really the energetic state. So cultivating a basic non-grasping, again, is a little more external, and now the instruction starts to turn toward the internal, peaceful and calm. Calm, of course, is a nervous system or emotional state. And, you know, sometimes we're calm and sometimes we're not. So the cultivation of calm is both the cultivation of conditions in our life that make calm more likely and the cultivation of the skill in achieving calm when calm has been disrupted, or re-achieving calm, regaining calm when it has been disrupted. And much of this skill, really, regaining peacefulness and calm when calm has been disrupted, comes from the skill of knowing how to deactivate when we get activated. So activation is kind of nervous system language for what happens when our animal bodies get startled or shocked by discomfort or threat. And it's, in a way, shorthand for the activation of the sympathetic nervous system, the fight and flight systems. And this happens all the time. Somebody says something that feels a little threatening to you, or you have something doesn't go the way you want, or there's an actual physical or emotional threat present, or there's just the low-level anxiety that the future may not be the way you want it to be. And in all of these cases, there's activation. There's a kind of heat and buzzing and kind of vigilance or muscular energy in the body that, in a very basic animal way, is the body, you know, preparing to defend itself or flee. And this is a natural phenomenon. It's not something to try to make not happen. It's the phenomenon that keeps us alive, you know, that makes us jump back to the sidewalk when we see a car out of the corner of our eye, or that makes us, you know, choose our pathways carefully when we're walking through the city. And it's a good quality. And at the same time, we can get habituated to activation because of so many conditions, so many ways that we can never really achieve full settledness. And so the practice of peacefulness and calm isn't just to say, you know, may I be peaceful, may I be peaceful, but really to learn to sense the fluctuations in energy in our own bodies. Really, it's a physiological process. And to notice, oh, I'm not at ease right now. What is that? And you might know why it happened. Like, oh, I had this conversation with somebody yesterday, and I thought it had resolved, but it hasn't really resolved in my heart. And so I can feel myself kind of reverberating with it, still activated. Sometimes we don't know why. It's just like, I don't know why. I just feel uneasy today. But in both cases, the antidote or the pathway through it is to connect more fully with the feeling rather than try to push it away or change it. And to actually be able, if we can, to slow down and say, oh, I'm still churned up. I'm still activated. What is that? And if we can, to feel it in the body. If we can't feel it in the body, to just gently hold the field of ourselves and say, okay, this is happening. Sometimes it helps to orient the space around me to be like, oh, right, I'm still activated from that conversation yesterday, but actually I'm here with these walls that are this mysterious red-orange. I can't quite tell week by week whether I think they're red or they're orange, but I like them. And I just like the way that they kind of glow with a deep color. And as I do that, that, you know, the part of me that was like, oh no, that conversation, oh no, that part, almost just by inattention, begins to let go. And the Buddha says this very clearly in one of the texts. He says, you know, when dealing with difficult, distracting thoughts, there's several methods for returning to calm and peacefulness. I won't do the whole list right now, but it's you know, one of them is just like just think something else, like forget about that thought and think something else, something more wholesome. And this isn't denial. This is really a way of saying, I know what this is, and I'm choosing to orient my physiology toward rest by turning my attention away from a threat that is no longer here, essentially. What anxiety and ongoing activation is, in many ways in the nervous system, is the animal body or the physiology still thinking that there's a threat when the threat has passed. The conversation was yesterday, and it's gone. You know, and whether the conversation itself was a threat or not, maybe I perceived it that way, but it's over. And even if I have more processing to do about it, I can realize that I'm not actually under threat in this moment. And of course, this practice depends on actually not being under threat, right? So this is not what one does when one is actually under threat. So I'm running away from my attacker, God forbid it ever happened, but it does. That is not the moment to go, oh, may I deactivate? That's the moment to run and be like, activation is great. And then when you get home, then you find your people and you shake and you cry and the body heats up and then real deactivation happens. You know? And that's, whether that's a literal attack situation or a subtle one, you know, difficult conversation, I process it as best I can, and then sometime later, I notice that the body is still vibrating, and I spend some time with it to just let it roll through. Sometimes I'll say that in sessions with someone. Someone will be having a feeling, and they're like, oh, this feeling, it's so hard. And the only hard thing about feelings is when they're either too much and we can't observe them, or we're afraid of them. And that both of those are respectable responses to feeling, but we can learn to, as I'll sometimes say, let them roll through, just like waves rolling through. And it feels like that. And once I stop hating it, actually very often a strong feeling is just like kind of interesting. Even if the strong feeling is like, wow, I'm so mad. But what is mad? Mad is just like my whole being is kind of vibrating and there's little sparks coming out of my ears. And it's like, whoa, okay, amazing, right? If I'm not under threat, I can just be like, I'm exploding. Gosh, you know? Or another time it's like, wow, I'm totally shutting down. And it's almost like, you know, this feeling of like, what's it like? You know that feeling like you're in a store, like, you know, you're in like Rainbow Grocery or like or the YMCA or, you know, you're doing something and it's closing time and you're not at the checkout yet or you're still on the treadmill or you're doing your thing or whatever, and you hear that voice that's like, you know, Rainbow Grocery will be closing in 10 minutes. And you're like, wait, I'm not done. And then they close. And they're like, Rainbow Grocery is now closed. Please leave. And they start to sort of dim the lights and it starts to empty out. But I'm still in it. And there's that feeling of it's just kind of shutting down around me. But I'm still kind of activated. So I'm in a difficult conversation. I want to stay engaged. And I'm like, oh, this is amazing. My being is shutting down around me. Like I can feel my brain going blank and my body going kind of dim. And I'm just like, wait, no, I don't consent to shutting down. Like I want to stay alert. And it's just kind of going, like, okay. And if you're curious, if you get good at tracking your system, or even just curious about your system, you can be like, check it out, I'm overwhelmed. And then if you can, and sometimes it's hard even to say this. I say this from too much experience. It's hard even to be like, out loud, to be like, oh, look, I'm shutting down. Like, that's all you have to say in a certain way. It's like, oh, look, it's happening. So calming, right? You can't calm yourself on purpose. That would be great. The spiritual path would be so much easier. It would just be like, get calm and quiet your mind. And you'd be like, cool. But calming and quieting and peacefulness are actually non-volitional. You can't make them happen. They are autonomic, like everything in the nervous system. So all you can do is be mindful in a bright, intimate way, loving awareness of yourself and the situation, and then create the conditions for deactivating, for calming. Often that's a little bit of time. Very often it's the feeling of safety such that you can bring your attention to your body and feel the energy shift is in your physiology. And it doesn't take long to shift. Our main stress hormone, cortisol, dissolves in the body within about 30 seconds of its being released from the brain. The trouble is every single new anxious thought releases more. And so the main thing we have to do is not obsessively think about the thing that's going wrong. And that takes some discipline, mm-hmm. at least. Skill. So the line is peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. And these go together. Right? Wisdom and skill is like understanding the framework of the mind and heart, how they work. And skill is really like having a toolbox and being able to get in there and do something. Right? How do you actually work with your energy? So much in this path is not being a victim of our own habits and patterns and conditioning, but really, really having some skills. Or we always have to say in my household, skills, you know, like bow hunting skills. And, does anyone know what that quote is from? Only a few boomers know that one. Right, Napoleon Dynamite. Quote, skills. It's the only way I can say the word now. My sweetheart has quoted that so many times that that's what I get for skills. Peaceful and calm and wise and with skills. You know, like... and then the beautiful qualities of humility, not proud and demanding in nature. And so from here, the text opens into ethics, and particularly ethics in relation to our own actions and a sense that our actions arise in community and especially in community of those we respect. And there's this beautiful line, it's a challenging line. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. This is a teaching on measuring our actions against the wisdom of ones we could think of as elders or teachers or the most respected people we know. It's a way of saying, you know, when you're about to do something, if my most beloved teachers knew that I was doing this, how would they feel about it? And this is, you know, it says like the slightest thing. So this is a fairly strict, you know, bar. I've certainly done some things where I'm like, what would my teachers think about this? And I'm like, I think they'd be okay with it. I mean, they've partied. You know, but like you don't really know, really. And I'm like, okay, maybe not, actually. And that's, the teaching is not to say like, oh, well, therefore that's bad. All of this is a teaching in developing wisdom. So the important thing about our actions is not that that we know for certain that they're good or we know for certain that we've done bad. That's not what it's about at all. What it's about is tuning up this very bright internal compass. What's important about actions isn't that they are, you know, that people approve of them or not. What's important is that our actions either support or hinder our deep wish for liberation, our deep intention to be on a path. And that's, I think, the thing that is most important here. You know, ethics only live within the container of practice. They're relational with others, but only you can really know what feels right to you. And so this teaching supports that, but it challenges what is maybe an overly like individualistic or free choice or hedonistic approach that at least my California culture has often had, you know, which is like, you know, if nobody's obviously complaining, then just like go for it, man. And this pushes back against that with the sense of a kind of communal responsibility. Don't do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. There's a difficult teaching or a beautiful teaching in the early Buddhist system that I teach on sometimes. the translations are frightening, so don't let them put you off. But this is a teaching that is translated as moral shame and moral dread. The teaching of shame and dread. Not the qualities that one thinks one wants to cultivate, but these are considered, these are called the two, either two bright qualities or the guardians of the heart in early Buddhism. And the Pali words are hiri and otapa. And moral shame, I prefer remorse, the gentler translation. But you have to hear it with a certain punch. That's how it works. Moral shame is not shame like the thing that Brené Brown preaches beautifully against. It's not that. It's moral shame is the quality of looking into the past in one's own actions and seeing all of the ways where our own actions didn't live up to the standards we would wish them to, that really weren't supportive on the path or were harmful for ourselves or others. And it means doing this in a very non-deluded way, as best we can, to really feel remorseful, to feel in our heart that we did things that had painful results. And this weaves perfectly, beautifully into the forgiveness practice, because, of course, we don't do that and then, the practice proposes that we not do this in a way where we're like, oh, I did that, therefore I suck. Like, it's not about beating yourself up at all, but saying, oh, I really feel the results of my actions. And I can see that they were conditioned, I did the best I could, but I feel them. They sting in a certain way. And then it always goes with its, they always come in a pair, moral dread, and again, yeah, but I don't have a perfect translation for the second one. Vigilance is the closest I've come up with. I don't like vigilance because we use it in the trauma world as a term for a kind of ongoing activation, anxiety, fear, which is not what this is. But this is like good vigilance. Moral dread or vigilance is the quality of being, it's so hard to say afraid and mean it in a positive sense, being afraid that one might transgress one's vows in the future. So it's a quality of looking into the future of one's own actions and saying, oh, I believe so deeply in non-harming and doing right for myself and others that I pray that I not lose that clarity in my actions in the future. It's the dread that you might make an ethical mistake. And so as much as you can, not taking these as any license to, again, further a pattern of self-hatred, but really just the opposite, that like, how fully, how beautifully can I love myself and others that my actions that affect both myself and others become my prime concern? And really like, oh, may I forgive and bow to all the mistakes of the past, and may I stay awake in relation to all the complexities that I will encounter in the future. And that practice then, right, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. That practice of tracking my own actions echoes out into my community and is seen by my teachers and also my peers, my family, my friends. And it unfolds into the core wish of metta or loving kindness, the prayer at the heart of this sutta. In gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. That's the mantra we chant every week. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu, may all beings be at ease. And so the way that the ethical urge or passion unfolds into the wish for the well-being of all. And there's a beautiful quality that's said to arise when you practice this for a while, where you've been taking care with your actions in the present. You have a strong commitment to act as wisely as you can in the future, and you've done some processing and remorse and grief practice and forgiveness practice for your actions in the past, so that when you sit down to be present with the results of your actions, you know deep in your heart that you've done the best you can and you've resolved whatever you can. You can make a parallel from this to the practice in the recovery community, in the AA community, of making amends. That you've made amends subtly and literally as best you can. And there's a state that the Buddhist texts describe called the bliss of blamelessness. The bliss of blamelessness. So like you know that you've done as clearly as you can your actions, and you can rest in yourself regardless of the result that came out. Because if you do your best and it goes badly, you know you did your best. And it went badly either because you didn't have the skill to make it go better, or the conditions, more broadly, were unsupportive of it going better, most likely both. In either case, it's not your fault in this kind of blame way. All of this leads to dropping the quality of blame from our hearts. It's just not useful. It doesn't mean we don't analyze situations, understand what happened, and it doesn't mean that we condone harmful actions on the parts of others or turn a blind eye to our own harmful actions, saying, well, it was just conditioned. All of that would be wrong view. It's really just a way of saying that understanding with wisdom and then committing to well-being weave together, and what arises out of that, what the result of all of that care, is just a deepening in this vast quality of love. May all beings be at ease. In gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. I'll say one more little piece about the forgiveness practice that we touched into during the meditation. This is a formal practice that's often taught as part of the metta or brahmavihara sequence. It's not one of the formal four practices, but for many of us, it's very necessary. We do the practice of wishing well to ourselves, using the metta phrases, or radiating metta to ourselves and others. And very often, the guilt or shame of past actions, or the wounds that were inflicted upon us from others, come up. And there's fear and anger and regret. And so the practice of forgiveness, like the rest of the divine abidings, the Brahma Viharas, is a practice. And in a way, it's an intention practice. The forgiveness practice has three components. Offering forgiveness to others for their harmful actions. Asking for forgiveness from others for our own harmful actions, and offering forgiveness to ourselves for our own harmful actions. And any one of those might feel impossible at any given moment. It's not like I can instantly just forgive another for the harm they've been doing or have done to me or others just because I decide today's my day to do forgiveness practice. Maybe I say, I forgive you for acting unskillfully and causing harm, and then what erupts is anger in my heart. And that's a perfect result of this practice. Right? This practice is there to open the door to what needs to be seen and felt in order for true forgiveness to arise. I actually think that doing the forgiveness practice is almost never the moment when forgiveness happens. I think forgiveness happens in the heart in mysterious ways. It's almost like we do the practice a bunch, and then at some point we just notice that that event no longer haunts us. And very often it's like, well, oh, what happened? I used to dream about that, worry about it, think about it, chew on it. I haven't thought about that in like 6 months. Wow. And you feel into it, and you can still feel that it was true and poignant and real, but the buzz, the punch isn't there. I think that's the sign that forgiveness has happened, or letting go. And they're the same thing, really. Forgiveness, in a way, is the heart quality that is part of letting go. So offering forgiveness to others, asking for forgiveness from others. And again, that means meeting the remorse or regret or grief of our own actions. And then the corollary, offering forgiveness to myself for my own actions. Very often, this is the hardest one for folks. Again, in a culture that encourages us towards self-hatred and judgment, this practice cuts against that very deeply. And all sorts of feelings may come up as we practice it. And the encouragement is just to stay with it, to return to it again and again, with the intention to be intimate fully with the entire range of feeling that is our human experience. And over time, the karma of the past resolves. That is the whole path, in a way, is resolving the karma of the past and not creating further misfortune in the future. All right. So, let's take a moment and just sit and let it rest. And your thoughts, ways that this practice, these practices ring a bell in your own life, in your own heart. Anything about your practice here? Yeah, I do.
It's not quite related to the mat, but I think of it from something you said tonight, and maybe this is kind of a more organic intelligence sort of thing, but I notice sometimes, like, I'm talking to somebody or something and I'm kind of like uncomfortable, or maybe they don't like them very much, or they say something that bothers me, and my body will do something that kind of betrays me.
Yeah.
So it might be something like whatever it is.
Yep.
But I've been pretty good at noticing that I do that, and then I kind of want to know, like a lot of times I'll just be like, don't do that. But then there's this kind of like natural, like that happens though. And like there's this sort of like protection impulse or something.
Yeah.
And like, so I want to know what's more useful. So is it to like, and not to like get what I want in the social situation, but
yeah,
to not like have that energy stuck in the body and
Yeah. I mean, you know. I don't know, how many times are you like, you're trapped at a party with somebody, you're talking, you're like, and you're just like, hang on, I gotta go pee. And you just sort of disappear. And you go in the bathroom, you're just like, and your friend comes to the bathroom, and you're like, oh my God, I got trapped in a corner with George. And your friend is like, I'm so sorry. And, you know, like, and you're just like, oh, shake it off. Like you know, there's this thing where, you know, you don't want to offend people.
Yeah.
You're talking to someone, and, you know, they're telling you all about, like, their thing, and you're just like, and you're right that it's, you know, it very often is this kind of self-instinctive, self-protective thing. And those things are great because they, you know, they're a little alarm, they're a little canary in the coal mine where you can be like, oh, I was pretending to like this person and I was pretending so hard that I kind of believed it for a second, but actually I'm totally not having fun here. And then you do both of you a disservice by staying in it, you know.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, so, you know, I'll restrain grimacing to somebody, but I'll be kind, and you know, be like, you don't have to talk to anybody you don't want to talk to.
Yeah, but you know. Like sometimes you do. Like.
But sometimes you do. Well, yeah, you know, if you're in a formal situation, like it's your boss at work or something like that. Then, you know, you do the appropriate self-protective mechanism, like you do you mildly do what you need to do to keep your job. That's a slippery slope. Like, and it might be that it's, you know, not a job worth keeping, or a relationship worth tolerating because other aspects are really good. Like yeah, relationships are complex, but I'm a little biased toward not offending people, but. But I'm also just, you know, neurotically conflict averse. So some other people would just be like, you know, they're just talking to the boss and they're just like, you know, whatever it is. And the boss is like, you know, oh, you know, he's really sweet, but he has kind of this nervous tic. Nervous tics aren't nervous tics, you know, they are physiological responses to stimuli. But if you have time to go on your own, like the person wanders away, they're satisfied with you and all that, and you get to sit down, you could just be like, oh, what is, let me just like, what is that? And you're just like, ugh. And you let it happen. And if you let those gestures often happen fully, slowly, you'll get the emotional hit of what they are. And you're like, oh, I just want to like, ugh. And you're like, cool, that's what it is. And then you get to feel that and kind of inhabit or own or integrate in a way that force, which is, it's just Shakti, like everything else. But it's self-protective.
But actually, that is kind of part of my question. It's like, because sometimes I will do something like that.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, like, say this urge to raise my shoulders or something.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that, like, if I really let that happen and really feel into it, like, it's really uncomfortable. But it's almost like then I don't even know how to let it release the whole way.
Yeah, so that's a practice. This is, there's several different kinds of kind of healing modality that are based in this. I did a hands-on bodywork form of Alexander technique for a while, a couple decades ago, that would like find the pathway the joint wanted to go in and then follow it all the way in until the system was just like, you know, but all the way in. And it was a little bit like saying, okay, you want to go there? Like, do it. Go all the way in. And then you would just wait. And nothing wants to stay contracted, so you follow it in, and then listening for it, and it's gonna drop, and it'll release, and you can follow it all the way out, usually in a spiral. And one thing you might play with, that we can play with it, if you're doing that, is, you know, you feel something, you can let it go in, but without trying to push it, not trying to be like, oh, I think I know where it's going there, but actually following and be like, it might not be what you think it is. There's a little subtle pathway. We'll do some of this in the sadhana class. Following the impulse, very, very, like, curious, without knowing where it's going. And then there will be a moment, it's a threshold, where, like, it hits its spot, and it's accomplishing something. And often, even if it's physically uncomfortable, it's accomplishing something, like, emotional or energetic. With something like this, it's often protection, right? So I might be like, oh, this is kind of just like this. I'm like, oh, I kind of, in a micro sort of energetic way, feel a little safer. Like, I'm protected. I'd be like, okay, that's what that is. And I'll just kind of wait. And there's going to be a moment where it just wants to go. And we do some of this in organic intelligence, partly because it's sometimes hard to do on your own because you can't see. Or because you're embedded in the energy. But you can just explore it. And, you know, really, so many of these practices are just like ride the wave in and ride it out. And the thing to not do is think you know where it's going or kind of try to push it in a predetermined direction, but really let it find its pathway in both directions. Yeah, it's subtle. It's good work. Other thoughts?
Not to be proud.
Yeah.
And like I generally, like there's definitely ways to be proud that are more arrogant and unhealthy. But like in general,
which is what it's pointing to.
Yeah. And you know, but I kind of just like ways that are good. And I wonder how do you, like, it's, so it's saying proud and it's not, like, going into any much defining about that beyond that.
Right, and of course, we'd have to look at what word proud is translating.
Mm-hmm.
And then look throughout the discourses to see how that word is used.
Mm-hmm.
To know even if it means the thing we think proud means.
Because
mm-hmm. that's always present in translations. But I do think it means a kind of self-inflated arrogance. But, like, what would be an example of a pride that we want to cultivate?
Yeah, like, healthy, like, something that, like, you did something good, and it feels good to acknowledge that,
mm-hmm.
and it's, like, a form of self-awareness.
Yeah.
Like, recognize what is good, what is a healthy thing to do.
Yes.
And to be proud you did it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The standard word for that in the even in this practice, the Brahma-Vihara practice, is the third of the divine abidings, which is mudita. And it gets translated as, like, sympathetic joy or appreciation. And it's very specifically the heart celebrating goodness.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you see that something good has been done by yourself or someone else.
Yeah.
And the phrase is, you know, may this goodness continue and increase. Like, really, like, yes, big yes to doing well in all these ways. And it gets directed toward yourself. So that would be a kind of, this kind of good pride that you're talking about is certainly there. And I think for a lot of us now, also part of what I think about when you ask is that, again, being in a culture that has so much self-hatred and self-blame and judgment taught to us and embedded in everything, advertisements and religions and you know, kind of educational structures and competition and capitalism, all wants us to feel bad about ourselves. That, like, pride becomes this, like, resistance against that, you know, in some way of saying I have basic worth and value, of self-valuing. And then, of course, there's kind of capital P pride, right, in the queer community, which, again, was taken up as a resistance against a systemic oppression of denigration. And so all of that, you know, feels really wholesome. Maybe the distinction is just, like, the difference between knowing one's basic worth and thinking that one's worth depends on being better than someone else, which is the kind of pride that
mm-hmm.
one doesn't want to be
mm-hmm.
here. But if there's a kind of basic value that every being has and could recognize, and the recognition of that value would be a kind of pride, you know, then, yeah, then that's, you know, I think for sure wholesome. And it's a good distinction to make. The same way that, you know, for a lot of you, even for, like, you know, shame and dread, like, I can't really teach those without being like, okay, it's not actually shame, it's not actually dread, but there's an aspect of, you know, seeing one's own faults and seeing, you know, but in a way where you just want to be really careful not to encourage the kind of, you know, self-hatred that we're so good at. So this would be one of those, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was, two things struck me. First, as you said, it was that the practice and sort of and the goal of the practice are the same.
Yeah.
Like if we sort of say sadhana in yoga, sadhana and the goal of the sadhana, the path
yeah.
and the goal are the same.
Yeah.
So these sort of like we practice doing these things, and that's how we get to
yeah.
be who we're practicing to be.
Yeah, absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely.
And then I was also struck by the first sentence is you know the being should that word should.
Yeah, this is another one of those that's
yeah,
like
some of those loaded words, but then it's. Let them, and the let them, I love that, it's like a prayer.
Yeah.
It's not like you should be, you have to be, it's a, I'm giving you a blessing, like sending a
yeah.
blessing, it seems like a prayer to me when it says
yeah.
let them. It's like
yeah.
I'm giving you good luck, go on your voyage, you know.
Totally, totally, I like that.
Little.
As well, and I like that particular translation, let them not, you know.
Good luck.
No, totally. You know, Godspeed, pilgrim. It's a challenging world out there, you know. Yeah, there's a bunch of different translations of this text, of course. I like this one the best, but I can't separate the liking it the best from the fact that it's the only one I know by heart and chant. And once you've chanted something, you know, 100 times, you can never chant another translation. There's even little moments in the chant where I do, I'm like, oh, there's not an arrow under that word, but I learned it with one. So,
And I have a misguided idea that Buddhists don't pray.
But we pray all the time.
Yeah, so that, you know, that
yeah, Buddhists pray all the time.
So this is sort of a prayer, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Buddhist prayer is gorgeous, you know, partly because it can be super passionate, but there's no, you know, there's no, like, omnipotent deity at the other end of the prayer. You're invoking qualities and wisdom that are not separate from you, ultimately. And even if you're in a Buddhist tradition that has kind of taken on the directional prayer, you know, if you're praying to Amitabha Buddha or Tara or, you know, Kuan Yin or something, or like Tibetan practice and Chinese practice very much, you know, did this. If you actually dig into the tradition, there's the recognition that all of those forms are empty, you know. In the same way, in a certain way, that in you know, in Hindu practice, if you go through the dualistic side of like you know, Vaishnava Bhakti, praying to Krishna, and, you know, you go through all the way to the other side, and sort of Krishna dissolves into Vishnu, Vishnu dissolves into Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, and all of it is just existence, you know. Likewise, in the Shaiva tradition, like, you pray to sort of Shiva, the, you know, the kind of anthropomorphized figure meditating on the mountain with the cobras and the moon and, you know, all that. But when it really unfolds, all that dissolves into no thingness. Yeah. And no thingness isn't owned, by the way, by the Asian traditions. Like, you know, like mystical Christianity did the same thing. You know, Jakob Bohm was oriented toward that infinite not knowingness. The gorgeous text called The Cloud of Unknowing is worth any yogi reading. The practice of Saint Teresa of Avila, you know, was profound devotional practice. But at the heart of her practice is the divine marriage, you know, with Christ consciousness, and the two, the feminine and masculine, divine, merge and dissolve into light. And, you know, she was said to be so ecstatic that her fellow nuns had to hold onto her ankle sometimes when she was meditating. She would just float up toward the ceiling and they would have to pull her back down. Who knows if that's true or not, but you know. She's one of my favorite saints, anyway. Not for the floating, but for the passionate, for the passionate part. Other thoughts here? Anything else about your practice? Any reflections on maybe the relationship here between the ethical foundations and the heart practice? I think this text is beautiful in drawing a clear line, you know, from like basic renunciation through precise ethics, and then into the wish for the well-being of all, and really connecting those in a lovely way. Yeah.
So, on a physiological level, you're able to see that there's like the ways in the brain how it thinks. Pour water down a path, like it will take the path wherever there's small water flowing.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering how it's connected with the heart, since, like, I can, depending on what thoughts I'm thinking, it's like it goes into my feeling realm, into my heart. So I'm like,
say more.
How thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. If I understand you rightly, something like there's the connection of thoughts and feelings. There's some way that, like, is what you're saying, like, oh, the heart practice depends on kind of an intention of moving toward loving or care or forgiveness, but then but the thoughts don't always, and they kind of direct things. Mm-hmm. Is that in the direction?
Yeah, the thoughts are guiding, like, I have the feeling I need my thoughts to guide my heart, right? Mm. But since my thoughts are, like, not really reversible, there's always going to be the pattern of, like, going into a misguided
yes.
way.
Right. So we use thought to propel the practice, right? I say the phrases again and again. I create the intention again and again to be loving. The thinking mind, like the breath, is this thing where we can do things with it volitionally. You know, it seems like I can decide to think about a certain thing and keep it going. And then it does things non-volitionally. It goes into its habits and patterns, right? So in a sense, what I do is I use thought as skillfully as I can to create more and more momentum for the heart, the feeling, to go in the direction I want. You know, so like maybe thought is, you know, I'm digging a channel for the water to go, you know, toward the big river. But sometimes it just doesn't. There's a lot of water, or, you know, there's a lot of other ditches around, and the water just, like, floods the garden or goes wherever the levee breaks. Like, water goes wherever there's an opening. And so in some way, like, the force comes through me, but I'm a little confused or my thoughts aren't gathered, and, yeah, it's going to go in that direction. And then I'm angry or afraid or confused or something. And, you know, and then I notice that, and I just go back to digging my ditch. I'm like, okay, well, what I can do is I can make, you know, I can just keep making a channel for the water and making an intention, and then also just doing the practice. The intention isn't enough. The practice really is to make the intention again and again and again and again, which is really like digging. You know, may I be safe from harm. How many times have I said, may I be safe from harm of all kinds? Like, at one point I did, on two different occasions, I've done this practice for a month or 40 days at a time, all day, every day, like dawn till dark, just the phrases around. Like, that phrase, I've said it a gazillion times. But so many times I'll say it, and my whole being will be like, eh, it's not happening. I'm like, yep. May I be safe? You're like, safe. And then every once in a while, it's like, may I be safe? And I'm like, yes, please. You know? And then every once in a while, I'm like, may I be safe? And I'm like, uh-huh. And then the next time around, I'm like, may I be safe? And I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know? And so it's just like, oh, it's like, it's the mind, you know? And you just keep digging. But you use the mind to dig. Right, and this is an amazing practice where you use thoughts to learn to direct thoughts, or to, if repeated thoughts are just a habit, like the habit of thinking I suck, I just need to, you know, essentially, like, make deeper habits. So if I've been thinking that I suck for 20 years, then it's going to take more than a few sessions of self-love to cut a deeper channel, because there's a really big ditch in the garden, you know, with a lot of water in it. And I just have to start digging another ditch. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So, thanks for being here. It's a pleasure. Sending prayers and blessings and wishes for safety and whatever material help you can do for the folks up north. One of the monasteries we tend and have visited, Abhayagiri, where the monks are who chant this. The monastery has been evacuated. It's in Redwood Valley, north of Ukiah. The last we heard, the monastery had not burned yet. I hope it doesn't. So we hope Bayagiri survives. I was at a monastery in San Diego when a huge forest fire came through, and we evacuated the monastery there also. That was the Metta Forest Monastery. And as we were packing up the cars with, like, you know, like all the food that could be packed up and you know, things and supplies and all of that, and there was like orange fire on all the hillsides around. Three monks were in the center of the courtyard, and they were doing this blessing that is an ancient Pali prayer called the baby quail protection, and it's a protection against fire. So, you know, it's like, it's the 21st century, and we're all like cool, you know, rational beings. And there's this tradition, and the fire is coming, like there's a prayer you can say exactly for that. And for whatever reason, it's the baby quail protection. So ancient shamanic practice, it worked, or something worked. The monastery didn't burn. I have no doubt that someone chanted it up at Bayagiri this weekend, and I hope they're all safe. So blessings up there, and blessings to everyone to be safe and protected. As always, your generosity sustains the group, and the possibility of having this space for all to come and practice and study together and create community and love each other. So thank you for your generosity, and your offerings. Donations go in the pretty box in the cabinet. There's a mailing list next to it if you want to hear from me about events and things. You can also donate at the desk using cards or class passes and things like that. See you soon. As always, you can keep these for home practice if you don't have one. If you have one already at home, then bring them back so you have them each week. What I meant by that was you don't have to bring them back if you have them at home, like, but just like you don't need to accumulate extras. That's what I meant.